academic year begins after the summer holidays and is divided into three terms, with the intervals between them formed by the Christmas and Easter holidays. The exact dates of the holidays vary from area to area, being in general about 2 weeks at Christmas and Easter, plus often a week or more at Whitsun, and 6 weeks in the summer, beginning rather late. Schools outside the state system decide on their own holiday dates, generally taking a month off at Christmas and Easter, and 8 weeks in the summer. The three terms are not everywhere called by the same names. Indeed, some schools call the January to March period the spring term. Others use spring term for the period April to July. Some call the January term winter term, which is logical. Others call it Easter term. Day schools mostly work Mondays to Fridays, from about 9 a.m. to between 3 and 4 p.m. Lunch is provided, and parents pay for it unless they prove to the authorities that they cannot well afford to. All primary school children, including those in independent schools, were given milk free of charge until 1970, when the government abolished this benefit.
That is the end of section one. You will have half a minute to check your answers. Now turn to section two.
Section two. Now you will hear the recording for section two. Matthew has a talk with Leslie, who is a teacher, about the school system. As you listen to the talk, answer questions 13 to 20. First, you will have some time to look at questions 13 to 20. Now listen to the talk and answer the questions 13 to 20. Leslie, you're a teacher. How does the English school system work?
Well, first of all, most children start school at the age of 5 and they can't leave until the age of 16, which is just, you know, the age group that has just been recently raised. They will then go to a primary school from the age of 5 until 11. And previously they used to take an 11 plus examination, which would then determine whether they would go to a grammar school or alternatively a secondary modern school. But now we have a new system where children aren't divided off at the age of 11 and will go into a comprehensive system of schooling and will do the things that they're best able to at certain ages, and if they want to take the exams they are able to at the age of 16.
Do you think that's an improvement to the system?
Well, theoretically it's supposed to be much better. It stops separating children off at the age of 11 and gives them a better chance. And in fact, what usually happens is that those children who will have gone to a grammar school tend to be at the top end of the comprehensive system, and those that will have gone to a secondary modern school find themselves at the lower levels of the school.
Do you think that the present school system is an efficient way of educating children?
Well, if you accept that, you know, there have to be schools, it seems to work fairly efficiently. Of course, one of our great problems in England is that we have very large classes, and it would be very nice if we could reduce that by at least half. Instead of there being 40 children in class, there are only 20. And so that each child gets more individual attention, so that their own particular needs just aren't passed over.
Do you think the subjects that children study today are adapted to present-day society?
It would be very good if more children at school had the opportunity of learning about the society they live in economic terms and in social terms, so that they are much more aware of the problems that we face today. But I also think that education isn't only something that has to be relevant. I think education can just be a gradual extension of oneself. And I don't think it's important for subjects to be seen only in terms of how useful they are when you leave school, but how much you enjoy them and how much they mean to you.
Then, as a mother, Janet talks with Matthew about her daughter's education. As you listen, complete the tables number 21 to 24. First, you will have some time to look at questions 21 to 24. Now listen and answer questions 21 to 24. Janet, do you think that your daughters gain a tremendous amount from their education?
I think they gain a certain amount of necessary knowledge, yes, but I wish it was broader. I wish that instead of being driven towards passing exams that they had, certainly at the stage of adolescence, the the chance to really broaden their outlook completely and not feel this necessity to read towards passing the exam to collecting a piece of paper at the end of it.
Do you have any specific ways in which you think time at school could be improved?
Yes. I think there could be a lot more encouragement in doing things for their own sake, for getting the satisfaction out of them rather than this rat race that everybody's forced into for what is achieved at the end. I think a lot more should be done to encourage people to get the value out of it themselves.
Do you think that education is just something that takes place inside a school building? Or is this an activity which takes place not only outside, but right the way through your life?
I think it starts the moment you're born, and that it's ongoing all around you. It's not just taking place in a school building. It should be part of your whole life.
That is the end of section 2. You will have half a minute to check your answers. Now turn to section 3. Section 3. Now you will hear a talk about problems that foreign students face. As you listen, answer questions 25 to 34. Look at questions 25 to 34. Now listen and answer questions 25 to 34.
Today, I'd like to talk about some of the problems that students face when they follow a course of study through the medium of English, if English is not their mother tongue. The problems can be divided into three broad categories: psychological, cultural, and linguistic. The first two categories mainly affect those who come to study in Britain from Asia and Africa. I'll come to comment only briefly on these two categories, and then spend most of the time looking at linguistic difficulties which apply to everyone. Some of the common psychological problems really involve fear of the unknown, for example, whether one's academic studies will be too difficult. Looking at the cultural problems, we can see that some of them are of a very practical nature, for example, arranging satisfactory accommodation. Others are less easy to define. The largest category seems to be linguistic. Let's look at this in some detail. Most students, in their own countries, will have had little opportunity to practice using English. When foreign learners first have the opportunity to speak to an English-speaking person, they may have a shock. They often have great difficulty in understanding. I'll just mention three of the possible reasons for this. First, it seems to students that English people speak very quickly. Second, they speak with a variety of accents. Third, different styles of speech are used. For all of these reasons, students will have difficulty, mainly because they lack everyday practice in listening to English people speaking English. What can students do then to overcome these difficulties? Obviously, attend English classes, and, if a language laboratory is available, use it as much as possible. You should also listen to programs in English on the radio and TV. Perhaps most important of all, you should take every opportunity to meet and speak with native English-speaking people. In addition, the student probably has difficulty in speaking English fluently. The advice here will seem difficult to follow, but it's necessary. Firstly, he must simplify what he says so that he can express himself reasonably clearly. Secondly, he must try to think in English, not translate from his mother tongue. This will begin to take place only when his use of English becomes automatic. Using a language laboratory and listening to English as much as possible will help.
That is the end of section 3. You will have half a minute to check your answers. Now turn to section 4.
Section 4. In section 4, you will hear a meeting about the problem of the size of the Olympic Games. As you listen to the conversation, answer questions 35 to 41. First, you will have some time to look at questions 35 to 41. Now listen and answer questions 35 to 41.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I declare the meeting open, and I take it you all have a copy of the agenda. so we'll take the minutes of our last meeting as read and get straight down to business. Now, the proposal before you is that we should see if we can reduce the size in any way and thereby ease the burden placed on the host city. We all know that each time we hold the games, this burden increases because of the vast undertaking it is to host them. Today, however, I only want to sound out your opinion of this proposal, so this is really no more than an exploratory meeting.
Could I say something straight away, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mrs. Armstrong.
I can't accept your proposal at all on the ground that I feel that to reduce the size of the Olympic Games would seriously damage their character, detract from the universal appeal and penalise certain countries if we start arbitrarily throwing things out before.
Yes, Mrs. Armstrong, if I may interrupt you for a moment, I think we all sympathise with your point of view, but we mustn't overlook the main point of this meeting put forward by the chairman, which is to see if we can cut down the program a bit, without in any way damaging the overall appeal of the games. So let's not reject the proposal out of hand before we've had a chance to discuss it.
Very well, Hermia, but I'd like to state here and now that I'm totally opposed to any reduction in the number of events in the games.
Your objections will be noted, Mrs. Armstrong, but to get back to the point of the meeting, could I hear from the rest of you what you feel? Senor Cordoba, for example, what's your opinion? Reluctant as I am to alter the composition of the Olympic Games, I can see the point that in terms of space and financial demands, the host city is subjected to a lot of difficulty. The costs seem to soar phenomenally every time we stage the Olympics, so we might be able to make one or two savings here and there. There is, for instance, quite a strong lobby against boxing because of its apparently violent nature, so I did wonder if...
But that is one of the most popular sports in the world and one of the oldest.
Agreed, but people get a lot of boxing on their television screens all the year round, so I was just thinking that we might be able to drop that from the program. Football is another thing which already enjoys a lot of television coverage. As it takes up a lot of space accommodating all the football pitches, mightn't we also perhaps consider dropping that too?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mrs. Patel.
I wholeheartedly endorse what Senor Cordoba said about boxing and football. In my opinion, we should concentrate on some of the more unusual sports, which are rarely seen on our screens, such as fencing, archery for a change, since it is on TV that the majority of the people watch the games.
Perhaps we could cut our hockey along with football, because relatively speaking, that takes up a lot of space, as measured against its universally popular appeal.
I can see your point, Hermina, and one of the basic tenets of the Olympic Games is individual excellence. I feel we ought to concentrate on some of the more unusual sports which really are a true test of the individual. I therefore suggest that we cut out, that is, if we go ahead with this idea, the team games such as basketball, volleyball, football and hockey. But then we're sacrificing some of the most interesting items in the programme. People like to watch team games as well as take part in them. It would be very dull without them.
I think Mrs. Armstrong has made a very valid point. We ought to keep some of the team games, although I am inclined to agree with what has been said about football. There is one thing I would like to say about this, and that is to suggest that we could remove from the programme sports like sailing and canoeing, and possibly the equestrian events, where the test is not so much of the stamina of the competitor, but of his skill in handling the boat or whatever.
What about the pentathlon then? Riding is one part of that. So are we going to need facilities to cater for that in any case? So why not use them for horse riding as well? Or do you think we should axe that too?
Well, let's not get too heated about it, as this is only a preliminary discussion about possibilities, and we are not yet in a position to make any final decision. I will, however, briefly summarise what has been said so far, as I understand it. Mrs. Armstrong is today opposed to reducing the size of the games in any way at all. There is one body of opinion in favour of removing from the games those sports which are already well represented in other international concerts and in the media. Another strand of thought is that we should concentrate on individual excellence by cutting out the team games featured in the programme. And Mrs. Patel suggested we ought to focus attention on the more unusual sports in the program, which do not normally gain so much international attention. Senor Cordoba also brought up the idea that we could drop boxing because of its seemingly violent nature. There was also an opinion voiced that we might exclude events where the skills of a competitor in handling a horse or a yacht, for example, were being tested, rather than the stamina of the individual himself, as is the case with, say, athletics. Well, it is quite clear that we shall need to discuss this further, but in the meantime, I think we'd better move on to something else.
This is the end of section 4. You will have half a minute to check your answers. This is the end of the listening test.
Day 74. Instructions. You will hear a number of different recordings and you will have to answer questions on what you hear. There will be time for you to read the instructions and questions, and you will have a chance to check your work. All the recordings will be played once only. The test is in four sections. Write all your answers in the listening question booklet. At the end of the test, you will be given 10 minutes to transfer your answers to an answer sheet. Now turn to section 1.
Section 1. You will hear a dialogue about job interviews. As you listen, look at questions 1 to 9. First, you will have some time to look at questions 1 to 9. Now listen to the talk and answer the questions 1 to 9.
Hello, my name is Hudson, Disc Hudson.
I'm Pamela Gable.
Well, take a seat, please, Miss Gable. It is Miss, isn't it? Thought so. Well, let me just check that I've got these particulars right. Your surname is Gable, spelt G-A-B-L-E, and your first names are Pamela Ann. Fine. You live at 147 Collindon Road, Croydon. Your telephone number is 2468008. You were born on July the 8th, 1965, and that's about it, okay? Fine. Let's see. What are you working with at the moment?
I'm the personal assistant to the manager of the modelling agency.
Oh, really? And what does that involve?
A bit of everything, really. I have to keep the accounts, write a few letters, answer the telephone, look after the bookings and engagements, and that sort of thing.
You work with a lot of people, do you?
Oh, yes. I have to look after all the models who work for us, you know, keep them happy, lend an understanding ear to their heartaches, you know.
Have you ever had anything to do with hotels or conferences? Hotel management, for instance?
No, not really. I did work for a short time as a courier for a tour operator, taking foreigners on guided tours of London. Perhaps that's the sort of thing you mean.
Yes, I think it is. Do you speak any languages?
Yes, I do. I speak French and Italian. You see, I spent several years abroad when I was younger.
Oh, did you? That's very interesting. And what about any exams you've taken?
Well, I left school at 16. You know, there didn't seem to be any point in staying on somehow. I was sure I could learn much more by getting a job and a bit of experience and independence.
So you have no formal qualifications at all? I see. Well, I don't suppose it matters.
I was wondering if perhaps you could tell me a bit more about the job. You know, it said in the ad that you wanted a go-ahead girl with car and imagination. But that's not very much to go on.
No, it isn't. Well, we run conferences, and your job as conference coordinator would be, well, much the same as the one you have now, I suppose. Meeting people, transporting them from one place to another, making sure they're comfortable, a bit of telephoning, and so on.
It sounds just like the sort of thing I want to do.
There is the question of salary, of course.
Well, my present salary is $8,000, so I couldn't accept any less than that, especially if I have to use my car.
Ah, we have something like $7,500 in mind, plus, of course, a generous allowance for the car. But look, if I were you, I'd take a quick look round the office here, see if you like the look of the people who work here.
What do you think I should do then? Should I?
That is the end of section one. You will have half a minute to check your answers. Now turn to Section 2.
Section 2. You will listen to a talk about the relation of salt and blood pressure. Listen to the talk carefully and answer the questions 10 to 19. First, you will have some time to look at questions 10 to 19. Now listen to the talk and answer the questions 10 to 19.
A salty diet really does drive up blood pressure, both in people with and without elevated pressure, according to a study released at the annual meeting of the American Society of Hypertension. For many years there has been a debate on how closely salt is linked to hypertension. I think this study may help settle the debate, that it is indeed a very important factor. Dr. Frank Sachs, a Harvard researcher who was in charge of the study, told Reuters. Sachs said the $12 million Dash Sodium study suggests that an intake of sodium below the current recommended daily level of 2,400 milligrams could help Americans prevent blood pressure rises that occur especially with advance in age. Sodium is the main ingredient of table salt, whose chemical name is sodium chloride. The study, conducted by five U.S. hospitals and financed by the National Heart, Lung and Blood Institute, NHLBI, involved 412 subjects aged 22 and older whose diets were carefully controlled and monitored over a 14-week period. About 57% were women and 57% were African Americans, an ethnic group deemed especially at risk for hypertension. 41% of the participants had high blood pressure. Patients were divided into two dietary plans, a diet of usual foods eaten by Americans and the so-called DASH diet, which is heavy on vegetables, fruit, and low-fat dairy foods, and low in saturated fat, total fat, and cholesterol. Members of each group consumed different levels of sodium at different stages of the trial. A higher intake of 3,300 milligrams per day during the first month, an intermediate intake of 2,400 milligrams per day the next month, and a lower intake of 1,500 milligrams per day the final month. Unlike many earlier food trials in which patients were largely responsible for monitoring their own salt intake, food was provided for everyone in the DASH sodium trial, that is, dietary approaches to stop hypertension. Results showed that reducing dietary sodium lowered blood pressure for both the usual and DASH diets. The lower the sodium intake, the lower the blood pressure, NHLBI said in a prepared release. The biggest reductions in blood pressure were found among those who followed the DASH diet at the lower sodium intake. That combination reduced blood pressure amongst all the groups in the study by more than either the DASH diet or lower sodium alone, said the agency, which is a part of the National Institute of Health. On average, the DASH diet combined with lower sodium intake reduced systolic blood pressure, the top number in a blood pressure reading, which refers to the pressure of the contracting heart, by an average of 8.9 millimeters of mercury. And it reduced the diastolic blood pressure, the pressure of the heart between contractions, by an average of 4.5 millimeters of mercury. Results were most impressive in patients with hypertension, where the combination of the DASH diet and lower sodium cut systolic blood pressure by an average of 11.5 millimeters. In those without hypertension, by contrast, the combination reduced systolic pressure by 701 millimeters of mercury. These are large effects on blood pressure, especially in people with hypertension. The effects of the DASH diet and low sodium are easily as good, if not better, than those achieved by taking hypertension drugs, said Sachs, an associate professor at Harvard Medical School. The average blood pressure of Americans is about 120 over 70. It is considerably lower in many other countries that have lower salt intake and diets richer in fruits and vegetables, Sachs said. Sachs acknowledged the 1,500 milligram sodium diet that produced top results in his trial takes some getting used to. For one thing, it rules out almost all restaurants, which put a lot of salt in for flavor. It also means you have to shop for low-salt prepared foods and have to put aside the salt shaker. But he said the diet was possible and potentially could prevent many heart attacks and strokes, especially for those with serious hypertension. At first, the food tastes bland, but after a while your taste buds adjust. They get acclimatized, he said.
This is the end of section two. You will have half a minute to check your answers. Now turn to section three.
Section three. You will hear a dialogue between Janice and Pauline about psychology of clothes. Listen carefully and answer questions 20 to 29. First, you will have some time to look at questions 20 to 29. Now listen to the dialogue and answer questions 20 to 29.
So you really believe that clothes carry a kind of message for other people, and that what we put on is in some way a reflection of what we feel? Oh yes, very much so. People are beginning now to take seriously the idea of a kind of psychology of clothing. To believe that there is not just individual taste in our clothes, but also a thinking behind what we wear, which is trying to say something we may not even be aware of ourselves. But surely this has always been the case. We all dress up when we want to impress someone, such as for a job interview with a prospective employer. We tend to make an effort and put on something smart. True, but that's a conscious act. What I'm talking about is more of a subconscious thing. Take, for example, a student who is away from home at college or university. If he tends to wrap himself up more than the others, this is because he is probably feeling homesick. Similarly, a general feeling of insecurity can sometimes take the form of overdressing in warmer clothes than are necessary. Can you give any other examples of this kind? Yes, I think people who are sociable and outgoing tend to dress in an extrovert way, preferring brighter or more dazzling colours, yellows, bright reds and so on. In the same way, what might be seen as a parallel with the animal kingdom. Aggressive clothes might indicate an aggressive personality or attitude to life. Think of the threat displays used by animals when they want to warn off opponents. Do you think the care or lack of it over the way we actually wear our clothes has anything to tell us? Yes, indeed. The length, for example, of a man's trousers speaks volumes about his awareness of his own image. Or if his trousers are at half-mast, all sort of hanging down, this probably means he's absorbed by other things. Really? Or to give you other examples, often minority groups, who have perhaps failed to persuade with words, tend to express themselves by wearing unconventional, or what some might consider outrageous clothing, as a way of showing your thoughts and feelings are different from the rest, and so they find an outlet in this way. That surely spills over onto other things as well. Oh yes, indeed, haircuts, jewellery, kinds of fabric used. These things can all be a form of rebellion. But to get back to clothes, I would like to add that a whole lot about our personality is conveyed in our clothes, and the way we look, aggressiveness, rebelliousness, happiness, sadness, and so on. These can all be interpreted. Think of the Asian pop star who may be pushing middle age. He'll keep on dressing up like a rebel to try to prove he's with it still, and in touch with his young fans and current trends. Do you think that at work, clothes and general appearance have any significance? Definitely. We've already spoken about the job interviews a bit, and it's interesting to note that in a recent survey, it was suggested that employers prefer young executives to stick to grey, black and dark blue suits if they are men, and classical outfits and dresses in sober colours if they are women. Perhaps because they feel this is a reflection of a more responsible and sober attitude to work, and will also project this image to the customers. Do you subscribe to this opinion? I personally think that too much conservatism defeats the objects of the clothes industry. They want to create new fashions and colours to sell clothes. So I can't really say that I go along wholeheartedly with it. There should be room for manoeuvre, leaving people scope to express their individuality in what they are wearing.
That is the end of section three. You will have half a minute to check your answers. Now turn to Section 4.
Section 4. You will listen to a talk about traits of the educated man. Look at questions 30 to 41 as you listen. First, you have some time to look at questions 30 to 41. Now listen to the talk and answer questions 30 to 41.
A question often asked is, what are the marks of an educated man? It is plain that one may gain no inconsiderable body of learning in some special field of knowledge without at the same time acquiring those habits and traits which are the marks of an educated gentleman. A reasonable amount of learning must of course accompany an education, but after all, that amount need not be so very great in any one field. An education will make its mark and find its evidences in certain traits, characteristics, and capacities which have to be acquired by patient endeavor, by following good examples, and by receiving wise discipline and sound instructions. These traits or characteristics may be variously described and classified, but among them are five that should always stand out clearly enough to be seen by all men. The first of these is correctness and precision in the use of the mother tongue. The quite shocking slovenliness and vulgarity of much of the spoken English, as well as not a little of the written English, which one hears and sees, proves beyond peradventure that years of attendance upon schools and colleges that are thought to be respectable have produced no impression. When one hears English well spoken, with pure diction, correct pronunciation, and an almost unconscious choice of the right word, he recognizes it at once. How much easier he finds it to imitate English of the other sort. A second and indispensable trait of the educated man is refined and gentle manners, which are themselves the expression of fixed habits of thought and action. "Manners make the man," wrote Wickham William over his gates at Winchester and at Oxford. He pointed to a great truth. When manners are superficial, artificial, and forced, no matter what their form, they are bad manners. When, however, they are the natural expression of fixed habits of thought and action, and when they reveal a refined and cultivated nature, they are good manners. There are certain things that gentlemen do not do, and they do not do them simply because they are bad manners. The gentleman instinctively knows the difference between those things which he may and should do, and those things which he may not and should not do. A third trait of the educated man is the power and habit of reflection. Human beings, for the most part, live wholly on the surface, far beyond the present moment, and that part of the future which is quickly to follow it. They do not read those works of prose and poetry which have become classic, because they reveal power and habit of reflection and induce that power and habit in others. When one reflects long enough to ask the question, how, he is on the way to knowing something about science. When he reflects long enough to ask the question why, he may, if he persists, even become a philosopher. A fourth trait of the educated man is the power of growth. He continues to grow and develop from birth to his dying day. His interests expand, his contacts multiply, his knowledge increase, and his reflection becomes deeper and wider. It would appear to be true that not many human beings, and even not many of those who have had a college education, continue to grow after they are 24 or 25 years of age. By that time, it is usual to settle down to life on a level of more or less contented intellectual interest and activity. The whole present-day movement for adult education is a systematic and definite attempt to keep human beings growing long after they have left school and college, and therefore to help educate them. A fifth trait of the educated man is his possession of efficiency, or the power to do. The mere visionary dreamer, however charming or however wise, lacks something which an education requires. The power to do may be exercised in any one of a thousand ways, but when it clearly shows itself, that is evidence that the period of study, of discipline, and of companionship with parents and teachers has not been in vain. Given these five characteristics, one has the outline of an educated man. The outline may be filled in by scholarship, by literary power, by mechanical skills, by professional zeal and capacity, by business competence, or by social and political leadership. So long as the framework or outline is there, the contents may be pretty much what you will, assuming, of course, that the fundamental elements of the great tradition which is civilization and its outstanding records and achievements in human personality, in letters, in science, in the fine arts, and in human institutions are all present.
This is the end of section 4. You will have half a minute to check your answers. This is the end of the listening test.